Hey, Dave, welcome to The Smart Divorce.
Good morning, Deborah. Good morning, Steve. Good to be with you today.
It's great to have you here. You know, I've read a lot of the articles coming out from the Institute, and I find them really intriguing, especially one of the ones that I read not too long ago about making marriages successful rather than divorce easier. I was quoted on that for one of the publications, and I found it very interesting how you think that divorce is too easy. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, in Canada, I can't speak for your American audience, but for Canada, divorce law really changed in 1968 and then had some minor changes in the 80s as well. And prior to that time, many people would say that divorce was too difficult to attain when that seemed to be the only outcome or that would actually resolve conflict within a marriage. I'm not naive. Marriage, unfortunately, does end in divorce at times, and we've seen a rise in that for a variety of different reasons. In the last several years, several provinces here in Canada, most notably Alberta, British Columbia, and Ontario, have looked at their Family Law Act. And part of it has been how to reduce the amount of conflict that goes on during that divorce proceeding. Now, I haven't been divorced, but I've certainly heard many stories. I've read many different pieces from people that have been through a very tumultuous and difficult process there. And so when we met with some of the policymakers and the legislators in those various provinces, obviously what they were trying to do was how to make that process easier through the family law court process. And we said, you are changing some of the things there, and some of them are changing for the better. But one of the pieces that I've said to them that they're missing is how can they make marriage better or more wholesome before many people actually get to that stage? And I think there's a variety of ways that can be attained. Some of it's very personal, and some of it can be influenced and impacted by the respective governments of different province levels as well as the federal level as well.
You know, I agree with that in terms of education. I think people need to go into a marriage better educated in terms of what this relationship really is all about and why they're getting into this relationship in the first place, like for all the right reasons, and have those important conversations. You know, I really applaud your efforts in keeping families healthy and strong. What are some of the learnings from your research that would help a new family dynamic stay healthy and strong?
Well, I think part of it is looking at what are some of the attributes of strong families? And one of those is communication. That open communication is really needed between mom and dad, between mom and kids, dad and kids. That family atmosphere really needs communication. That's where a lot of the breakdown actually occurs. One of the easiest ways, and this sounds so incredibly simple, but research bears it out, is the family dinner. I know that we're busy households and, you know, there's music lessons and soccer practices and things get busy in the way of us. However, being sure that we can sit down as often as possible, it doesn't have to be a fancy meal. It can be, you know, a sandwich or, a plate of macaroni. That doesn't really matter what the meal is, but just that we spend some time together, that we actually talk and say, how was your day? What happened at school? What happened at work? What were the challenges with that? How did you face those issues? How was that test you had today? Those sorts of things increase the level of communication, increase that level of dialogue. And that's one of the biggest barriers that we have is when we're not communicating, that's when problems begin to occur and fester.
You know, I totally agree with that. As a matter of fact, I have a rule in my home. I don't know, Steve, do you have one like that too with your son when he's around? Friday nights. Yeah. We have to have dinner together Friday nights.
How did that get away from us? I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, everybody had their dinner together. I know women started working more, but even before that, the TV started, you know, getting pulled into a lot of family dinners. And it's like, gosh, it's so simple, but you're so right, Dave. You sit down with your family and you download the day. It's great.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I do like that you download the day. And the other thing is, like, I notice my kids will go for the remote. You know, they want to turn on the TV, and then if they're not watching TV, then they will play with their iPhones or their BlackBerry or whatever. And so now, and I have a rule: there's no phones at the table, and we can't even answer the phone while we're eating dinner. We shouldn't, unless you know it's a double ring, and then I know it's my parents calling. But you know, other than that,
double ring. You have a special ring for your parents
when there's a long distance phone call.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, any long-distance phone call. So usually it's marketers, telemarketers that call during dinner. But other than that, seriously, you know, I think it's just so important. We talk about the high and lows of the day. And Dave, I think that's an excellent point that people don't often do enough, is just sit around and talk around the dinner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that one of the biggest, some research that we did about 6 or 7 years ago, the biggest challenge that families face, whether they're just starting out, they're newly married or getting together, they're starting to raise children, or whether they're all the way through to retirement or perhaps senior citizens looking for, you know, those the comfort of care in those last years. The number one challenge for all those range of families is family finances. And so we've talked to our provincial and our federal governments here in Canada a great deal about a concept we call family income splitting. Now, your American listeners will be able to already file for income tax jointly, and that's something that Canadians don't have the luxury of. And so I don't want you to speak to the American side of your tax law, because I'm not an expert in that category at all. However, Canadians have not had that luxury yet. And so it's something that the federal government has actually said that they're going to do once our federal budget is balanced within the next couple of years, if everything holds true at this particular time. But we know that family finances is one of the biggest issues and challenges in families right now. You know, how are we going to pay the rent? How are we going to pay the mortgage? You know, in some families, it's how are we going to pay for the food for this week as well? You know, in other families, as kids get older, how are we going to save and manage for post-secondary education? Is there family holiday in the works or not? And many families all across North America have been facing some really tough financial challenges in the last several years here. And so that's one more impediment, one more wedge that can often drive between mom and dad and blow apart the family in some way. And so we need to find ways, whether it's our personal spending habits and some financial counseling might be appropriate there. It might be saying, how do we not keep up with the Joneses, so to speak? How do we maintain a level of financial expenditures that actually we can meet with our level of income as well? You know, many families have gone from two incomes to one income in the last number of years due to financial pressures in the marketplace. And those are challenges that we have to adjust for as well.
You know, but that also goes back to communication. And as we know, there are many, many blended families and families just living together. And they need to have that conversation in terms of finances. Like, what is a partner bringing in terms of debt? You know, what are the expectations? And I don't necessarily know if people are having those important conversations until they get married. And then all of a sudden, like you say, finances become a major obstacle.
Right, right. And in fact, you raised another good point there that I think is important in before people actually get married, is that pre-marriage counseling is increasingly a more important thing. You know, you just mentioned about finances. It's important that couples learn how to discuss these issues very clearly before they ever get to those challenges and those problems. You know, are we bringing debt to this marriage? Is there student debt or previous household debt that is coming into this relationship? And other questions along that as well, like, how, you know, you've heard the term fighting fairly. You know, if we hear of a couple that have never fought, we actually question who's holding back here and who's burying their feelings. You know, people need to be able to communicate openly that, you know, quote unquote, I don't feel comfortable with this right now. I don't like the way this conversation is going or how we're making this decision. So that has to be an openness there as well. How do we raise our children? Is corporal punishment in or is it out? Those are very personal decisions that, you know, the couple need to make as they're starting to go forward. And those are good questions to be asked during a pre-marriage counseling time to at least start that conversation. So as they get into serious relationship and into marriage, that they will actually have a basis, a foundation to grow and build on at that point.
You know, I think those are excellent points. And I think that your research, I'm reading more and more about your research in the media. Is your message getting out there? Like, are people having these conversations? Because I talk about it as well. As a matter of fact, I'm writing another book about the conversations you need to have so that you can have smarter, longer lasting relationships. But why is it that people don't have those conversations?
I think it's a matter of we've become a very me-oriented generation the last, you know, two or three decades. What can I get out of a relationship? And unfortunately, I don't think that's the way to build a relationship. I think the right way to build a relationship is, what can I contribute to this relationship? How can I give into this relationship to make it better? It's not about what I can get out. And generally in society, and I'm kind of broad brushing here, but when we look at how society has gone the last number of years, it's all about me. And unfortunately, that isn't a good way to start and build a relationship. And our kids see that. You know, there are many television shows that sort of focus on the all about me role of within society. And I think we've got to get away from that. And that message, yes, is getting out there, but it's slow. You know, when we're going up against television shows and multimedia and YouTube videos and everything that's out there, it's difficult for people to move past that. We live in a very high-paced, fast-talking world. We want instant answers, and we need to actually be sure that what we're doing is we're building long-term relationships, and that takes time. That takes communication. It takes self-sacrifice and building for the future, not just for this moment right now.
I'm not so sure parents are doing their job, though, and trying to educate the kids when they know they're now falling in love and they want to get married. You should maybe help them along with, you know, have you asked these questions? Have you thought about this? And personally, I've always thought that getting married should be just a little bit harder. It should cost a little bit more for the marriage license. It should have requirements where you have X amount of sessions. I know the Catholic Church tries to do that. Before you get married, they sit you down, and I think that's a good idea. But what's the hurry? I mean, anyone can get married, a couple of bucks for a marriage license, and you're married.
Yeah, I fully agree, Steve, where we, you know, in one sense, we've made divorce too easy. We've also made marriage very easily as well. And it's the single biggest relationship, not financial, but single biggest relationship that we'll actually look at for long term. And unfortunately, the majority of divorces actually occur in low conflict marriages. Research varies a little bit, but 10 to 15% of divorces are in those high conflict marriages where there may be there's abuse or sexual abuse or drug or alcohol dependency and things that you know are ugly and if they can't be changed or corrected or counseling doesn't work, then unfortunately, in my opinion, divorce may be the only solution. Keeps people satisfied and safe, and I mean that literally safe. But when we actually talk about the other 85%, those marriages are very much salvageable. And exactly as you say, Steve, if people actually looked into this and started their marriage, not just the day they got married, but, you know, prior to that, so that they actually went through some counseling and people asking some tough questions of them through those counseling times, saying, have you talked about these issues? Do you understand what he or she is trying to do when they want to do this? What are your long-term goals as a couple? And those questions often aren't asked until, you know, the honeymoon period is somewhat over. And by that time, you've got, you know, parallel train tracks starting to diverge instead of coming together.
I like that metaphor. You know, it's almost like in school we have sex education, and I think they should have relationship education as well.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, if kids don't have good role modeling in terms of their parents and having these conversations, or even sitting down at the family table and having these conversations, how are people going to know that they have to communicate in this way? And I see this.
I
was just going to say, I see this all the time in my divorce consulting practice, where I don't think many individuals really understand their partner and their needs until they get married, and all of a sudden they're faced with huge discrepancies in terms of their values.
Right. Right. And suddenly they're faced with these enormous decisions they have to make, or these gaps between, you know, partner A and partner B, and they're not sure how to bridge that chasm. And hence the you know, communication falls apart and the relationship falls apart as well. I agree. In fact, that's one of the recommendations that we've made in a couple of papers, actually, is that our education system needs to include something about relationship building, whether it's within the curriculum or whether it's with a guest person that comes in from the outside that talks about, you know, what is this thing called marriage? What is this thing called relationship? What does this actually look like? Much Music did a survey about 4 or 5 years ago that asked students, you know, the teenage years, roughly from 14 to 17, 18 years of age, to say, you know, they asked a lot of questions, but one of them was around marriage and relationships. And the vast majority of teens at that time said, I'd like to get married and I'd like to have a long-term relationship with my spouse. But we don't talk about that very much within society. We don't teach our children, and you're right, Deborah, we don't teach them at our dining room table, nor do we teach them necessarily in school. And yet I think this is crucial that just along with career counseling and financial counseling, we need to talk about relationship counseling as well. And I think that's very, very important, and we're missing it in most curriculums right now.
Now, you talked about students and what they think in your research. What's the younger generation thinking about in terms of cohabitation versus marriage? Is there a different perspective now?
Well, cohabitation has become very, very accepted across society. Within Canada, about 17% of relationships are cohabiting. In the province of Quebec, it's actually about double that, about 34-35% of relationships are cohabiting relationships. The downside is that marriage and cohabitation are not the same thing. They may look like it on the surface, but they actually don't have the same attributes. Those couples, and this will be a surprise to many people, those couples that cohabitate before they get married are actually more likely to have a divorce in their future. They've gone through building a relationship, assuming some things through cohabitation as if it's a trial marriage. In fact, it's more likely a trial divorce as opposed to a trial marriage.
Yeah.
The attributes of marriage outweigh cohabitation on every scale. If you're married, you're more likely to earn more. You're more likely to be healthier. Your children are more likely to do better in school. Now, there's a number of reasons with that, because you're with somebody. There's two people to share those burdens of finances, helping your children, and so on. But there's also something intrinsically that we live better. We tend to be happier people. That we self-acclaim that we're happier people. Now, those are broad brush statements, I realize, and there's exceptions. I've given that as speeches at different places, and almost always had somebody come up to me afterwards and said, well, I've been living together with my partner for 15 years, and we are really happy, and we really enjoy life, and our kids are doing extremely well. And I say, congratulations, you're the exception, not the norm. And whatever you're doing, keep doing it well, because it's working for your relationship right now.
But this, I read this the other day, and I thought this is really interesting. So maybe it goes to why people start living together in the first place, especially the younger generation, you know, those in their early 20s. It's like, you know, they're dating and then they spend more time together. So they're sleeping at one person's house a couple nights a week and then the other person a couple of nights a week. And before you know it, they figure, well, let's just cut down on the rent. And why are we, you know, we're practically spending all week together, sleeping at your house or my house, might as well just rent together. And then right. Before you know it, they're living together, whereas they're not making that decision necessarily for this long-term relationship. They're kind of falling into a relationship, whereas with marriage, you're making that commitment for a long-term relationship. And maybe like that couple that had kids together, they're thinking more along the lines of a marriage, you know, like a
right.
long-term relationship.
Right. And your analysis of that is exactly right, Deborah, that they're falling into something that sort of looks like marriage, but it's more of convenience, you know, because of the rent. You're like, there's no sense paying two rents. Let's just pay one. We can buy groceries more effectively together. We're spending all this time together anyways. And so they're falling into that relationship form rather than making a commitment to each other. This particular is important with the mental well-being of young women that fall into that exact scenario, that young women, more than guys, are looking for commitment and attachment. And they more often don't feel that in a cohabiting relationship, because while there's a freedom of coming together in that relationship, there's equally a freedom of leaving that relationship without any quote-unquote strings attached as well. And that actually puts young women in particular at a certain risk of emotional and mental well-being. I mean, it will vary from person to person, but it's actually measurable, and there have been a number of psychologists and sociologists across the country that have written around this issue quite specifically. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris in California has written about this quite extensively, of the differences in the mental health issues of young women in those types of relationships. So it's something that is noted and measurable in the long term as well.
Well, is that going back to the way, I don't know if it's the way men and women are hardwired or just society perceptions, but it's almost like, you know, when you look at sex, women have sex because they want to be in love. They want the passion. And men, you know, without sounding too stereotypic, but I guess I am, you know, can have meaningless, mindless sex. Like, it doesn't really matter. So what we're looking for... You know, well, it's true. Like, what we're looking for in terms of the male outlook versus female outlook is sometimes a lot different.
It is very different. And in fact, it sounds funny when we say it like that, but it's actually very true. It really is. There was a time when and I don't want this to sound old-fashioned, but there was a time when young men had to go in court a young woman, and he had to prove his worth to her. That I am stable, I've got a job, or I'm going to school, and here's my plans, and you know, whether it was through the parents or the daughter or whatever, that they sort of prove their worth because of those things that you just said, you know, to just be able to jump in the sack, you know, why would I do anything else? Because I'm getting what I think I want and need. I don't have to prove my worth anymore. And so we see that, you know, a lot of 20-something men playing video games half the time and not proving themselves as being worthy partners in a marriage, but rather just simply moving on with life. You know, they're sort of teenagers mentally in an adult style body. And we need to move beyond that young men need to take responsibility for their actions, and young women need to take responsibility for their respective actions as well. And when we just simply, you know, allow sex to just be this pleasurable act, but no attachment or no emotion or no intimacy involved, it becomes strictly an act as opposed to one more part of the marriage relationship.
Right. Lots to think about and lots to talk about. And I wish that, you know, the younger generation would really have those conversations. But I think perhaps they might feel a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Changing it up a bit. I know that over 50% of the population is single.
Yes.
And I know your colleague, Andrea Mrozek, is that how you say it? M-R-O-Z-E-K. So, you know, she talked about that, the state of singlehood. And when you look at being single versus married and happiness, and we know that more couples, you know, an individual's happiness is predicated, I think, really on being a couple. Like, many people are happier in a couple rather than being single. So going back to that conversation in terms of what makes for a happy marriage, it's those societal values. But when society says it's a Noah's Ark society and you should be a couple, like, I don't know, like, do people fall into these relationships because they don't want to be single?
Well, you know, I think that's true in some cases. The self-concept of age and I should be married will vary from person to person. You know, am I quote-unquote over the hill for marriage at a certain age or not? And I'm not going to say an age because I'll get myself in trouble with somebody, and I don't want to do that. But the concept sort of accepting whatever is there, you know, you reach a certain age and I'm not married yet, and he or she seems like the best thing I've got at this moment, so let's get married. That does occur, but there are also many that are just simply waiting it out and getting married at a later age as well. Dr. Mark Rigneris at the University of Texas actually did some interesting analysis around this very issue, and that there are some young couples, some young people that are holding off on marriage because they want to finish school, they want to finish grad school, they want to get a good basis in a career started, maybe pay off their student debts and things of that nature. And so when they may have been married at an early age, say the early to mid-20s, and they're holding off to late 20s, perhaps even early 30s now for marriage, you sort of have these two people that are independent. You know, they they're educated, they're perhaps financially independent as well. I don't mean wealthy, but I mean they're able to pay their bills on a regular basis and so on. And now you've got, you know, maybe 25, 30, 32 years of life experience behind them as well, and they try to put these two relationships together, and it's hard because they've already built their own habits around what they do on the weekends and what they do with how they spend their money and their priorities and things like that. So they try to clash these two things together, as opposed to at one point, couples did get married at a younger age, you know, those mid-20s, maybe 22 to 25, somewhere in there, and they faced many of those challenges together. And so they built their relationship on facing finances or children or job changes and those sorts of things, and they face them together as opposed to face them individually. And it's changed the way that we look at those relationships and build for long-term things as well. It doesn't fully answer your question, Deborah, in terms of why people are not getting married, but it's one of the outcomes that comes with that as well.
Right. In your research, have you done anything on happiness? Like really, what is happiness and what drives people?
We've dabbled a little bit in it. I mean, happiness varies from person to person, but there are some common denominators. How I feel happy is more than just a physical experience around me, that I have a warm house and food on the table, but rather what makes me happy intrinsically. What's my long-term benefits? And so when we look at that, and we look at especially in marital relationships, of what do I receive out of this relationship by giving into it? How do I contribute, and therefore what makes us happy? I enjoy seeing my children grow up. That creates a happiness in me, even though, you know, for every parent out there, we know how much work it is, and those early mornings or late nights or sick nights or whatever it might be. But at the end of the day, we say it's all worthwhile. And so happiness, while it will vary from person to person and what makes us happy, happiness is usually something that we give, and therefore we receive more out of the process rather than just simply, I'll sit back and wait for happiness to come at me. And a lot of that is relationships. What do I contribute into it will create this happy atmosphere, will create something that I can benefit from as well. And so happiness is something that a lot of sociologists are starting to study in the last several years. And we're sort of watching what some of those researchers are saying and what creates happiness in us as opposed to unhappy or sadness in somebody. And so we're watching that to see how can we apply that to marriage relationships and family relationships.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
Aren't some people just kind of wired to be a certain way, though? I thought there was a special I saw on TV where some people just seem happier than others. It's not related to circumstantial things. It's just the way they are.
Well, and that's an important piece of that puzzle, Steve. I'm glad you brought it up. You know, some of us see the glass half full, and some of us see the glass half empty. Scientists and sociology people, or psychologists and so on, are trying to figure out how does that hardwiredness interact with what our circumstances are and what we bring and contribute to those types of relationships. I think there are many people that would see the glass half empty that are still very happy individuals. They may be more somber. They may see it as half empty more often than half full. But at the same time, they still face life well. I think we've got a lot to learn around mental health and emotional health and how we create the best atmosphere for ourselves, but certainly for our spouse and our family as well. We've got a lot to learn around those issues in particular.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to resilience. Like, why are some people more resilient than others?
Very true. And I think part of it is the way we've been raised. Did we experience some things as children that we carry right through life? And it can be the same circumstance that one child faces and is very resilient and moves ahead. And in other children, that's a major impediment to them, and they never sort of really get past that at some point. So, and why is one face it well and one face it not as well? Those are areas that we're relying a great deal on the researchers to explain more for us as we sort of penetrate the mental and emotional side of our psyche and of our mind, that how can we learn more and understand it better.
Right. Now, in terms of resiliency, I did read something about children of divorce and how they might be more resilient to negative experiences rather than versus children in intact families, because they've never had any kind of bad things happen to them.
Mm. That's interesting. Elizabeth Marquardt out of Chicago actually has written a book called Between Two Worlds, and it's about children who grew up in a divorced household. And she herself is a child of a divorce. And so she wanted to do more research around that very type of issue. And so she interviewed young children, teenagers, older, in early 20s sort of thing, to ask them those types of very questions. How children have done within those relationships. She found a number of different things. this and other related research found that, you know, in some cases, children who grew up in a divorced household were saying, I never want to be married because I saw what it did in my household, my family, when I was growing up. There are also the other children that grew up in a divorced household that say, when I get married, I want that to last forever.
Yeah.
So there's the same situation, a divorce situation, but two very different takes on it. You know, I never want to do this again, or I want it to work, and therefore I'm willing to put whatever I can into it to make it work as well. So we do have a lot to learn around this whole issue of what challenges children face, you know, specifically in marital breakups as well. We do know that there's been difficulties. The kids have had difficulties, unfortunately. And since the last 40 years, we've seen a rise in divorce. We need to learn more and understand how that's actually facing it. We often have this misconception that divorce is actually plateauing. And by the numbers, divorce is plateauing right now. But at the same time, marriage is plateauing as well because of the cohabitation relationships that you just mentioned a couple of minutes ago. We don't track cohabitation statistics within vital statistics. You know, here in Canada, and I believe most states as well, we track marriage and death and divorce and all those, you know, vital statistics, as we're called. But we don't track cohabitation. And so where divorce looks like it's flattening out, we actually know that cohabitation breakups are occurring, but we're not tracking how many of those are. And so we've got this anomaly within our statistical tracking right now.
Right. That information would be very interesting. I think it would be very helpful, too, for people getting into relationships and just the outcomes.
Right.
You know,
right.
Going back to children, because we do know that they're the greatest sign of hope for our community and society. What do you think co-parents need to understand so that children are positive contributors to society? You know, like the importance of education, responsibility, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, one of the indicators that we can track is level of poverty and the, you know, the three indicators, and this sort of research has been done internationally, U.S., U.K., Australia, Canada. Three good arbiters of stopping poverty are get married. First of all, finish high school at least, and maybe go on to trade school or to university, college after that as well. Get a job and get married. And so those three indicators are fairly universal that if you follow those three principles, the issue of poverty in the future declines dramatically. And so we need to be able to teach our children, both within the education system, but also in the family format, back to that dinner table discussion that we talked about earlier, that these are important factors in your life. And these are things that need to be taken seriously. You know, I'm not saying a 12-year-old has to make those life decisions at this point, but if we talk about them as family and that we indicate that these are important things, the kids grow up to understand those things that much better. When we could look at, you know, dinner table talk, it's easy to talk about movie stars or rock stars and things like that and say, well, you know, we just saw that so-and-so has broken up with their spouse. How do you think they feel? How do you think those children feel? Do you think they could have done anything to help and improve that relationship before it actually got to this stage? And so, you know, kids track with superstars, sports players and celebrities and movie stars and things like that. And that gives us as parents a natural way to bring that conversation in a healthy way to the dinner table and to other examples that we're talking about as we're driving to soccer practice or whatever it might be. And I think we need to take those opportunities to discuss that with them in order to make that as all-inclusive, as wholesome for children, that they understand the parameters of relationships as best as possible.
I think that's great. That's really a great thing to think about because many of these celebrities, athletes, whoever we talk about, high-profile individuals, they're role models. And I don't think, you know, not a lot of them are great role models, you know. There are some that are incredible role models and others that you kind of wonder, like, why do children want to emulate them?
Right.
So you make some great points. Well, you know, I promised to keep this to half an hour and we've really gone over. I could probably speak to you for another few hours. Are there some parting thoughts that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think that, you know, just having this type of a conversation is a good place to go. You know, as we delve into the issues of marriage and relationships and how do we make it better, I think that hopefully your viewers or your listeners have had some opportunities to think about some challenging points and say, I never thought about that before. And so as we look at marriage and relationships, we have a lot to learn. But there is a good body of research that says this is a healthy thing to go through and support as much as we can, but recognize that there are, you know, that 10 to 15% of relationships that unfortunately are going to be difficult and going to cause problems. But I hope that if your listeners can take away something to how to make their relationship stronger, either with their spouse or with their children, that's a good and healthy thing. And I'd love to have a continued conversation with you sometime down the road, Deborah, as well.
Oh, would love it too. There's so many wonderful topics.
So how do our listeners get in touch with you, David?
Well, the best thing is to come to our website, which is www.imfcanada.org. And all the research that we've talked about and much other is on our website and available for people to access. And there's a way to contact us on the website as well, that if they have a question that they're looking for information or research that they don't see at first glance on the website, we'd be only too glad to react to that and to provide research wherever we can. I just hearken out, we're not a counseling agency ourselves. We're research and policy people, but we also work with a lot of people across the country, in the U.S., in Canada, U.K., Australia, that have built up a good body of research. And so if it can benefit people, whether it's their academics or whether they're high school students or whether the family's looking for ideas, we'd be only too pleased to help.
All right, great.
Are you funded by the government or is it private?
No, it's all private. We don't receive any government funding, and it's all generous people that support us because they believe in the institutions of marriage and family as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
All the best.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Steve.